Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty. And a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. Mob rule, mob mistress, king of the mob, dragons of crime, undercover. Those are not lesser-known Elmore James novels. Those are true crime books, nonfiction, about organized crime in Canada, written or co-written by James Dubreuil. Dubreuil is a career crime writer and documentary filmmaker. He is a former producer at the CBC's Fifth Estate, former president of Crime Writers of Canada, also a former landlord and former rare books dealer, and James Dubreuil will be with me in a moment. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Allison Creekside, Victor, Karen Routledge, Greg Cawley, Stephen Noble, Lee Elliott, Andrew Russell, Matthew Douglas, and Dalton Holloway. Dalton, why did you decide to be awesome?
Because I believe that there needs to be more voices speaking to the Canadian perspective, and Canada Land provides that extra voice, and I'm willing to put my money.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. but often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. That's BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand.
Got it.
This episode is also brought to you by FreshBooks, painless billing, cloud accounting with FreshBooks.com, the original sponsor of CanadaLand. A very useful service that saves me time every month. Use it, freelancers and small business owners, to invoice, to track your expenses, to send bills, to get paid quicker. FreshBooks.com/CanadaLand. You can use it for free for a month. And if you do sign up to be a paying customer of FreshBooks, tell them who sent you. You'll be helping the show. Thank you to FreshBooks. The mob is not an organization that takes very kindly to people exposing their inner workings. Why are you still alive?
You know, it's funny you should ask that question. That was the very question when I was on my first book tour in 1985 for Mob Rule that wonderful guy Webster asked me. Remember that wonderful Scottish accent? Tell me, James, bro, why the hell are you still alive? And it was live television.
The mob doesn't like journalists and the mob doesn't like gay men. They kill homosexuals in their own rights.
Well, that's both of them are kind of myths. They use journalists, of course, and they play the game. What they don't like is gay mobsters too much in the mafia.
In their own ranks.
Right. And, in fact, the reason that Charbonneau was shot in 73 was he'd written about Frank Catroni having a bisexual side, which he did.
Uh-huh.
But that was a no-no. He was getting into his private life. They don't mind the reporting, and it helps them in the— It helps them in their communities to say, hey, that's me. A lot of people bought Mob Rule and say, hey, I'm in this book.
I remember just, I know so little, but just Tony Soprano watching himself, you know, there's a sense of that there's no greater consumers of mob, you know.
Them. Oh, yeah, they borrow.
Media, literature, movies.
They borrow from the pop culture. I mean, there's a very famous assassination in Canada of one of the leaders of the Sicilian mob being assassinated, leaving a showing of The Godfather in some theater. So they try to imitate that. It's symbiotic relationship?
Yeah.
You know, the thing they really are concerned about is if you get into their personal lives, their wives or their lovers, same with the bikers, they're pretty much used to it. The general rule is with all these groups, if they're all organized, is you don't go after reporters, you don't go after cops.
Yeah.
That's why very few cops are ever bothered, very few reporters are ever, think about it.
Have you ever been bothered?
Not terribly. I mean, I've got a few threatening phone calls. One guy jokingly said I should be sleeping with the fish, you know, and I had another threat once for a historical book, strangely enough. I did a book on Rocco Perri. He was very big. I mean, he was the first major mafioso leader in this country outside of Montreal. And in Montreal, there's no indication there was anyone that big.
And what do you mean by big? Because don't we go back to the beginning of bootlegging?
It was bootlegging that did it. He started earlier. He came from Italy around the turn of the century, a little after the turn of the century, and he was involved in hits and other things. And he hooked up with this Jewish lady named Bessie Starkman, and they became quite the team. She ran the prostitution. He ran the thing. And then they both decided to get into bootlegging when the booze was, you know, prohibited.
Mm-hmm.
And she then dealt with the corruption, and she was one tough lady, boy. She was murdered in the most sensational mob murder ever, but that's a whole other story.
What happened to the Jewish gangsters? There used to be—
Well, it's interesting. Now, she was a Jewish gangster, but she was really, her power rested being the spouse, because back in those days when you were common law, you were really the spouse.
Yeah.
Her grave, which is in a Jewish cemetery in Hamilton, says Bessie Perri Starkman on it.
Uh-huh.
And then somebody tried to wipe out the Perri. She was assassinated in her garage by two hitmen from Rochester, and they never convicted anyone of it. And more people came to that funeral than any other mob funeral ever, because the Canada Games were going on in Hamilton then. So spectators were everywhere, and Rocco was almost pushed into the open grave. And the reason for that is she had hooked up with Anna Rothstein in New York for her drugs. She saw the next thing as being heroin and drugs. So she was getting drugs from Rothstein's gang.
So we're talking way back then.
Yeah. Rothstein was already dead by the time she was killed, but she still owed money.
Yeah.
And the story coming from RCM informants then, and I take that with a grain of salt then as I do today, was that she laughed at these guys who came to collect the money. Well, Rothstein's dead. Why shall I pay it, you know?
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, there'll be serious consequences. And then she was murdered. So, never solved. But what happened to the Jewish gangs? They're still around. I mean, they're back in the 20s, there were major Jewish gangs in Montreal and Toronto for sure. They were muscled out by some of the Italians. A lot of them, you know, so the whole thing of becoming legitimate, the Bronfmans,
yeah,
who were not professional criminals but who worked with criminals, they just became legitimate. So the second and third generations are totally wonderful, you know. I mean, the philanthropists, what have you.
Well, yeah, that book, Tough Jews by Rich Cohen, he talks about the big difference was the Jewish gangsters, they didn't want to pass it down to their kids.
Yeah,
I think
essentially that's true. And also they weren't as – okay, the nice thing about the Italian mob as organized by Lucky Luciano and all that is it became – and even going back further, it became a family tradition. You know, you're born into the mob. Basically, though, Prohibition was the big, big heyday, even in Toronto here. There were tons, and a lot of them were absorbed by Rocco. Rocco Perry took in all sorts of people. Paul Volpe had a multicultural mob.
Uh-huh.
He was the last mafia boss in Toronto. He 50s and 60s, 70s, and was murdered in still unsolved murder, November 13th, 1983. His body was found in his wife's company car. And no one's ever been charged with that murder. No one's even been charged, let alone convicted of that murder. There's a lot of unsolved murders in organized crime, and no one ever bothers to follow up on these things.
Do you like these guys?
I can't say. I like some of them. I don't particularly like... I shouldn't say that. Chucky Hanover I've met many times, and I would call him an acquaintance.
You say that...
But I never trusted him because he was a con man.
Yeah.
A chapter in my book about him is called Con Man Extraordinaire, and it's not flattering.
Yeah.
And yet, when I first met him, he wanted copies of the book, and he wanted to give it to every new girlfriend.
Well, these guys are, you know, there's criminals and thugs. The culture glorifies them. They are very involved in... glorifying themselves, their interest in, like, why, if you're a criminal for your career, why would you speak to a journalist? It's because you want that status. The same reason why I guess any celebrity would talk to a journalist. So
right.
I want to know more about your role, because there is this like almost to the level of like Star Trek trivia, where people are obsessed with these guys.
Yeah, I know.
And you have to have at least, I don't know if you like them or not, but you have to at least find them engaging enough to spend.
Engaging is a good word. I like that. I mean, I find a lot of them interesting and engaging.
And they use you say? They use journalists.
Yeah, I mean, one I'm very close to for many years is Cecil Kirby. He was a hitman for the Camiso family. Cecil called me a couple of months ago, and 6 or 8 weeks ago, and told me that he was going to give Peter Edwards of the Star a story about how the RCMP didn't protect him at all, and they were the worst people in the world, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, how the witness protection program, he was the first on it, totally failed him.
You did a story with the Fifth Estate in the mid-80s.
We had a disguise for him, but we didn't change his voice, which is crucial. The skies wasn't great. And incidentally, they weren't supposed to rebroadcast without contacting Cecil. And usually they do that through me, right? And in fact, I had a call a couple of years ago from Bob McEwen of the Fifth saying that they wanted to do an update on him. And so I set it all up, and then I never heard anything. And then they just ran this item as one of Bob's best stories, but without telling us.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly the day after that, the day of it really, Cecil got calls, people recognized him.
Yeah.
His voice particularly. And his life was seriously endangered.
The CBC exposed your source?
Well, I can't say they exposed it because we did it back in 84.
Yeah, why wasn't he exposed the first time around? Just luck of the nobody
knows?
Well,
at that point it was too early and he wasn't living where he's living and he didn't have a family and kids and all that.
So he's been in witness protection for 30 years.
Right. More than that, actually.
And then the CBC reruns as like a greatest hits package,
yeah.
the original story you
no
did.
No pun intended.
And you tried to get in the middle of it and say he changed his voice. No,
I didn't get in the middle of it. I didn't know what was going on. I just watched it the night it was on. They didn't tell me either.
Uh-huh.
They didn't tell Gordon Stewart, who was the producer. I was the...
Like, mean, I could see where they're coming from. I mean, if it was safe to run 30 years ago, it's
absolutely. And that's what they're saying in their answer to Kirby's lawyer. And
yeah.
I think basically they're offering to take it offline where they put it online. But of course, it's just as dangerous to the Camisos, who now pretend to be total legitimate. And he was the hitman. He talks about all the murders and the ordered by them and some that he did for the RCMP on, you know, that he didn't go through.
In my experience, removing content from the internet is not a good way to stop people from viewing
it. No, it's available. Once it's out there, especially for months. So, no, the only interesting thing is, that it did jeopardize his security, and they should have done some update, and then we would have brought to their attention, because Ron Haggart, who was the executive producer, standards have gone down a lot. You know, in the old days, Ron Haggart was a really wonderful guy, but he put you through the grinder to get a story on the air, gave you every possible reason why it shouldn't be on the air. Now, just about anything gets on the air. You know, I think one of the worst examples I've seen on the Fifth Estate recently was the Ford story that they felt they had to run. They didn't have to run a Ford story, and it was so weak.
Yeah.
And they had this guy who was actually being charged with having a gun and being a member of one of the Somali gangs. They had him saying these guys with – I love this. You know it's the same person when they say this. These guys, swarthy guys with gold chains and big cars started coming into their hood.
Yeah.
And that's supposed to be the mafia. Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, if the mafia really were putting pressure on a Somali gang, they'd do it very directly. They wouldn't be coming
in. Well, and the description is offensive unto itself.
I know, and
as
they
a
used
shorthand,
it in the Globe recently.
Yeah.
About that, this Vaughn hit.
Just a week ago or so.
Yeah, and it's total nonsense. And now it turns out it was a black hitman.
Yeah.
Well,
the whole thing is very confusing. In the shorthand they use and the code, they said it's a dark-skinned hitman, which is a different thing than saying it was
a black hitman.
I
saw his picture, yes.
Okay, and then, yeah, some neighbors saying, oh, there are these guys with gold chains been coming to this place.
Well, to be honest, the guys with gold chains and the fancy cars generally aren't mob. I mean, mob people, senior mob people don't go around like that.
Yeah.
Very few. They're kind of wannabes or hang-arounds, as we call them. You know, I mean, they're not
My uncle Mo wore gold chains and had fancy cars. He was in the kosher poultry business.
Any Marvin Elkin, he called himself very low level. He was a driver, you know, for various people. He always wears gold chains and talks the talk, you know.
But yeah.
He's the furthest thing from a mob boss.
Are you investigating crimes while police are investigating
yeah,
crimes?
Sure, sometimes.
Or are you sitting down when a gangster wants to write his memoirs and you're there to take the stories down?
It's all of these things, you know what I mean? When we did Connections and when I wrote my book on mob rule, I think if you read critically, say, mob rule and then read, say, a book on Papalia, you'll see the difference is that I have actual mob people and people are very close to the mobster talking and the other one doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
I won't mention any names. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's journalists have gotten a bit lazy. You know, they pretty much take from the police what they can and from the public domain, which includes whatever I've written over the years.
Or from the courts. I mean, it's just
and
there.
And the courts, of course, and that's fine. That's fine. Courts are very important, and they don't necessarily attribute everything, you know. I mean, they'll give you a vague, you know, thing in the back, but they don't attribute everything. And so I was just thinking last night, I was thinking of coming to see you, of all the stories and people I've met over the years, especially the last 15 years, that haven't become a book or a television documentary. And I've done a lot of television documentaries because I just couldn't sell it or it just didn't gel. One was a Colombian drug dealer who worked undercover with Bill Blair. Most things don't pan out into a book or a film, and I don't necessarily want to do that unless it's worthy of it, you know. Like Marvin was one I met in –
Marvin.
Elkin.
Yeah.
I met him in 85, and he wanted me to do a book. I found out he was – he called me after an article. I did a cover article for Toronto Life on Paul Volpe after he was killed. And he called me and said, hey, kid, this is Marvin. Volpe didn't come back from Haiti on January 2nd, 1963, but July 10th, and I picked him up at the airport. Oh, well, okay. So he became a good source of mine. I figured out eventually that he was also working with the OPP.
Uh-huh.
And so he was an informant. But he was also running his own operations, criminal operations. He was very much in the boxing world. Anyway, he wanted me to do a book about him, and I just couldn't sell it to my thing. I mean, he was an interesting low-level criminal. He grew up in an Italian mob family, and he was a really interesting guy. But it just didn't didn't play.
It's interesting the way you pursue this. It's like, can the story sell? It's a different thing than being like a beat reporter. Just here's what happened today. You're trying to find. You got to have a taker. You got to have the Fifth Estate's got to buy a documentary. You got
to. Well, I don't go to the Fifth Estate much anymore. I did in the after I left in the. I worked at the Fifth Estate for 3 years. I don't know if I mentioned that to you. By the end of the 80s, I didn't much bring it to there or W5. I've done some W5 things too. Fifth Estate has to be a whole hour now.
Who's even doing that anymore? Who's doing the crime stories?
Well, nobody.
In Canada?
That's the problem. You see, the whole attention span, the whole in-depth reporting has changed.
Yeah.
You know, it's all the way the news cycle works nowadays is it's very short.
You're working on something and you get information that the cops might not have. What do you have to do? What are the ethical considerations when you're investigating crime as a reporter?
Well, you don't have to share it with the cops unless it's, you know, a murder plot about to happen.
I mean, that would be it for any source talking to you if you were dropping dimes to the police.
Oh, yeah,
and yet,
yeah.
If you know something about an unsolved crime.
Everyone plays all sides. I mean, I know everyone pretends they don't, especially journalists. Journalists share information with the police all the time, and
yeah.
They get and exchange things, and with gangsters. And gangsters share information with the police all the time. Almost all of them did. Volpe was a source for the RCMP. They didn't want to have him officially recruited, but he was a source. And he was the boss of the Mafia of Toronto.
Isn't that a very dangerous thing to do as a gangster?
Yeah, but it's done all the time. It was done in the United States all the time, and it's done here. Some of the heads of the Teamsters were working for the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the most notorious gangster, Bulger, was definitely an agent for the FBI, you know.
The Boston.
Well, he killed all these people, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty bad, but that's.
Was that The Departed? That was Nicholson's character.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he was just convicted of many murders. And there was a story about him just a couple of days ago. He wrote this very nice note to a couple of girls in high school saying, don't use my career as a role model. I'm a terrible role model. I went bad, you know. My brother was a good one because my brother became president of the Senate, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
President of the University of Massachusetts. In other words, he seems to have regretted
the path.
Well, I don't believe it, but anyway, the point is that he has got a lot of publicity, and he actually hid 10 years, but he was working for the FBI. That's the whole point. And it's big story in Boston that he was working for the FBI, and there was a corrupt FBI guy in there too to top it all off. So everyone was playing all sides. The Departed. While it exaggerates all that, and you remember that was very interesting. Some people are paying three sides.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's a little bit complicated. I found it even complicated to think. But that's what was going on, really.
Those stories become American gangsters and the journalists who cover them, they sell the rights to make movies out of that. I can't really think of a lot of fictional depictions of Canadian gang activity.
No.
Do you sell the rights to your stuff? Does that happen?
I just a year and a half ago sold the rights to the Rocco Perry book, which I wrote in 87. And Rocco and Bessie.
Yeah.
And he's never been made into a feature film. Now, they did do a docudrama for a series called Mob Stories. It was a 8-part series for arts and entertainment. No, it was for the History Channel.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a joke, the History Channel, because they're not really history.
Not for a while, yeah.
No, and they weren't even then. I mean, they changed an opening scene in the Volpe one. And I said, you know, this didn't happen this way.
Yeah.
It was the scene where Volpe was at a hotel in, I don't know, 61 or something, 59, I can't remember what year. And there was a robbery happening, and a guard was stabbed. And Volpe came to the rescue of the guard and apprehended the criminal and then disappeared.
Uh-huh.
And he was a hero, mystery hero. Picture in the paper, mystery hero, Paul Volpe. And the way they played it as the opening of the history thing was that he was meeting with gangsters, and this was part of a mob feud. It had nothing to do with the mob.
Yeah.
And I told them that. And they said, no, the History Channel likes this story better.
They took
give me a break.
They took their liberties.
Yeah. They take a lot of liberties, so it's not really history.
Do you think – I mean, you know, and that's pretty low rent when it comes to like, you know, fictional crime on the screen. You know, why haven't we seen the big film
It's a good question.
About our gangsters.
It's a good question.
Is it a Canadian thing where we feel like a Canadian mob, that can't be anything? I mean, we've got the bikers here. We have a connection to the birth of the mob with the bootleggers here. We're leaving it to the Americans. Like, the Canadians start to show up in, you know, Boardwalk Empire because it's a part of that story. But we don't seem to be very interested in telling that part of our history.
Part of the Boardwalk Empire thing was Rocco Perry, who was feeding booze of those cans that pop up in the beginning credits, you know, they're coming
Canadian
from Rocco Perry and Bronfman's and various other people.
Yeah.
No, we don't. And I remember after I wrote The King of the Mob, Sid Eilman, who at the time was the star movie and entertainment critic, said there should be a film about Rocco Perry and Bessie and his second common-law wife, Annie Newman. She was a character, too. Still hasn't happened. I mean, I sold the rights to the Rocco Perry thing about a year and a half ago. It hasn't happened, although I was then approached because at that point the Bonnie and Clyde thing was big and women gangsters, so they really wanted to focus on Bessie. And I got three different people that wanted to do it, including someone from Hollywood. So I just basically went with what I considered the best, which is a local company run by a guy named Peter Gentile, who did the mob stories. But whether he'll get the feature film, I hope he does.
Yeah.
Who knows? But that just became trendy female gangsters, you know. And it's sort of interesting that Bessie was so important. I mean, she would have assassinations. I read the file on her murder, which is still secret. It's not available.
How'd you read it?
I read it because the OPP let me read it.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't even take
notes,
photocopies.
Sir.
Well, yeah. I took the notes afterwards. But
anyway,
in that file, everybody in Rocco Perry's gang had a reason to kill her. They all hated her because she was such the tough lady.
Right.
She was the
hard
one.
Hard crime to solve.
She was the one. He was Mr. Nice Guy.
Yeah.
And people, I remember this guy who rang me up to threaten me. Eventually, he said, yeah, I didn't tell you the story. This guy threatened me after that book came out, called me up to say, I'm no rat. This is Milty Goldheart. I'm no rat. And no one calls me a rat and gets away with it. Yeah, I said, I didn't really mean to say you were a rat. I said it was the RCMP said that you were cooperating for a few months. He said, yes, I did, but they tricked me.
Uh-huh.
He told me the whole story about how they tricked him, and so I got that into the paperback.
Uh-huh.
And then he told
Better book, possibly saving yourself
Sleep
with the fishes.
And unfortunately, he died of a heart attack before I could do a really thorough camera interview with him, but he would have been a great Fifth Estate piece or W5. But he told me he worked for Annie Newman, which was the second common law wife of, and he said, oh, she was incredible body, you'd want to fuck her, but boy, she was a hunk of shit to work for.
Uh-huh.
Tough as nails again. She was someone that came in through Bessie and his second common law wife, and she ran the bootlegging in reverse because it was they had to import booze from Chicago to Canada because the restrictions were so tight. So she did that, and she did the gold frauds in the 30s and 40s.
Certain kind of crime reporter, especially if you're a columnist who takes a high-minded moral position as you write about this stuff, can have a very, very successful career. And I can think of some newspaper columnists who've done very well sitting in courtrooms and just writing about the atrocious
Burton's
things.
A good example. He was a
But you've been a freelancer.
Most of my life, yeah.
Why? And you've had to do other things.
The only full-time job I ever had other than freelancing was at the Fifth Estate for about 3 years. That's not true. I worked for another company called Stornoway Productions. Do you know that one?
Yeah.
In fact, I'm having lunch with someone from there today. But basically, I was freelancing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been freelance. Well, you have more independence, more flexibility as a freelancer. You don't necessarily have the money. I was lucky that the reason I'm able to still operate, and I don't operate as much now, I'm going to be 69 in 10 days, but I invested some of the money from my first few books, particularly Mob Rule, which was a big hit in 85, into real estate, and that made me a little money. You know, so I can, my retirement will be comfortable enough.
I read that you're a landlord and a used book dealer.
Well, I not a landlord anymore because I just sold the only apartment I had left for renting out just a little while ago. But, you know, I bought it for $50,000 and sold it for $210,000. So, you know, that's how it goes. Bookstore, yes, that was not one of my great commercial successes. I ran an online bookstore for 5 years, and that was pretty good.
Yeah.
The physical bookstore, I came sort of – the time I opened was around the time of 9/11, and it was in the Ryerson neighborhood. And all the tourism just dried up.
Yeah.
And it sort of broke even but wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
It wasn't worth the hassles. I had an opening party where I had Chucky Hanover. I had Marvin Elkin, a couple of gangs. I invited some cops, but they didn't show up.
Uh-huh.
So the gangsters came. In fact, Chucky tried to pick up one of my crime writer friends.
Yeah.
She's now very famous, but I won't mention her name. He offered her a ride home in his motorcycle.
Uh-huh.
But he's that kind of guy, you know.
Yeah.
Full of gumption. Any rate, the bookstore was fun, and I love, you know, I still have too many books in my place. I have about 35,000, because I used to teach literature before I became a freelance reporter. I was teaching 18th century literature.
Do you ever write crime literature? I mean, it seems like a lot of crime writers want to be Dashiell Hammett.
No, I didn't write crime literature, but, you know, a lot of the writers in the 18th century, I was in 18th century literature, they weren't the writers I was writing about, but a lot of the writers were crime writers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think of Daniel Defoe, Henry Fielding, who was the Justice of the Peace, a lot of their periodical writing, even Dr. Johnson, were crime stories. I mean, and it was whatever – Grub Street, as it was called in the 18th century, was as bad as anything in the 1920s in North America, or the yellow journalism in, you know, the turn of the century. It was pretty big.
Yeah.
And crime reporting was a big deal, as it was here in Canada in the 20s. It doesn't seem to be now. The Globe kind of
– Yeah, they don't do much for it at all.
And they don't put as much emphasis on the Somali versus Jamaican gangs. It's very interesting. In Toronto here, we have black organized crime, and they have a unit of black organized crime, but they don't call it that anymore. Of course, an Asian organized crime, but they don't – political correctness has a lot to do with this.
Yeah.
They often don't even identify – people as being Somali or in a Somali gang or Haitian gangs are very big.
Toronto Star didn't have that problem. But no,
the Toronto Star didn't. You're right. And who was the great guy there that used to cover gangs? Nick Prawn.
But crime is at an all-time low.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's why.
And organized crime is. You know, in Toronto, I would say the mafia is, in spite of the efforts of certain writers to promote it, mafia is pretty low-keyed in Toronto.
Yeah.
It has been since Volpe was killed. I mean, there isn't a lot of mafia crime. There is a new group of Ndrangheta people that came, but they're quietly living in the suburbs of Vaughan mm-hmm. and Woodbridge and wherever. They're not so much involved in crime here in the city. The inner-city crime here in Toronto is black organized crime, Asian organized crime, Russian, all the other newer groups. You know, you have grow ups run by Vietnamese gangs.
Mm-hmm.
You have Somali gangs and drugs. And, of course, these are services and products that people want, certain people want. And that's why it's when they legalize drugs finally, which I think might happen in my lifetime. I'm going to be 69 and 10 days, it may or may not happen, but that will really hurt organized crime.
Yeah.
And it'll hurt those gangs.
Yeah.
It's
part of the story that doesn't get a lot of focus is that this is a part of the immigrant story of North America.
Right,
people
it is.
People come in and a certain segment, people start legitimate businesses, people start corner stores, and some people do this kind of stuff.
They fill in
the blanks that legitimate society doesn't want to.
It was a chapter in Mob Rule, The Theory of Ethnic Succession in Organized Crime by Francis Yanni, a sociologist.
Uh-huh.
And you could say that. And certainly the Vietnamese came in after the Chinese. And there's a newer generation of Chinese from the mainland.
Yeah.
And the Somalis who are at the lowest of the low in the gangs. That's why these people at Ford was associated with the Somali gangsters that were not very good. I mean, they're getting killed off every time they go out to Alberta to do drugs.
Uh-huh.
And even here, they're just not very high up there. The Jamaican and the Haitian gangs really run the street in Montreal now.
Right.
More so than the Rizzuto family.
Uh-huh.
This is really something when you think about it.
It's that process of legitimization, I guess, through the years.
Yeah, and Rizzuto's two children are lawyers.
Yeah.
Surviving. The other one was a gangster, but he was murdered, sorry. he was murdered. So I would say the Rizzuto family still exists, and I'm not sure who the boss is. I don't think we'll know for a while. There's all sorts of theories, but it's not none of that is as powerful as it used to be. Not in, when Controni ran his family, not when Volpe ran Toronto. And nobody has run Toronto.
Yeah.
In many, many, many years, decades, really.
Favorite gangster in Canada? All time?
I have to say Rocco and Bessie, but Rocco, because he was such a nice – I mean, he'd go give silver dollars to the kids in the ghetto here in Toronto in the ward.
Mm-hmm.
He was a prince, as Milton Goldhart said of him. He was a driver for them.
That's where my grandfather was born, in the ward. That's sort of, really sort of where we are now, yeah. More like university, I guess.
Yeah, we're not far from the ward, but the ward was the melting pot for everything. And you had Chinese massage parlors, you had Jewish bootleggers, you had Italian gangsters. And I remember when I was writing my bit about the ward, there's a book out about recently, various excerpts. I don't know if mine's in there. But basically, this artist told me, Florence Vale, that they would go to the Italian bootleggers, you know, back in the 50s in the ward. You know, this was a great melting pot, and everyone knew everyone. And a lot of people came out of that area, construction people, judges, all sorts of people who later became prominent. And they kept their connections with the criminal element, you should say. That was sort of a lot of fodder for our connection series back in the 70s. Hard to believe it was so long ago. Life goes by very fast sometimes.
James, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was your Canada Land Show. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me always at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read them all. I respond when I can. I'm on Twitter at Jesse Brown, and the show's website is canadalandshow.com. The crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand. I make the show with Katie Jensen. The next episode of Canada Land Commons will be up on Tuesday. The next episode of Shortcuts up on Thursday. If you like this show, please support it. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.